the key to successful compliance with Section 106 of the National Historic Preservation Act is planning. The archaeological procedures required for compliance take a long time to carry out, much longer, for example, than most of the environmental compliance procedures. You know, it just takes far more time to carry out an archaeological survey than, let's say, a wetland survey or an endangered species survey. So in order to get through the process successfully, you really need to start well in advance. And that requires good planning. Good planning means, you know, you have, you know, competent contractors in place and you're familiar with the procedure and you've kind of mapped out on your own timeline the things that need to get done. And, you know, you've created a relationship or you've built a relationship or you're building a relationship with the consultation parties that you need to be working with. For this reason, a lot of the people in government who are involved in this process are in the planning department. I've worked in planning departments in government agencies, and you know, it's not a bad place to work. And so, you know, if you're thinking about a career in this very seriously, you know, you could do worse than take courses on like planning. And you can get certificates in planning, urban planning, government planning, project management, things like that. So the key to success is good planning, and good planning implies having a long enough lead time to do everything properly. What you don't want is you don't want an engineer to come up to you and say, you know, I've got all of the earth-moving equipment, you know, sitting on site, and I'm paying, you know, $10,000 a day for those guys to sit there, you know, and drink beer and run the engines, and I can't get anything done until you're finished with your part. That's a nightmare. That's absolutely a nightmare. You know, the finest example of this kind of planning that I've ever seen is that there are some federal agencies which manage land, and they succeeded in applying to Congress and the executive branch for funding under Section 110, which is to say the section of the law that requires them to have a historic preservation program. And they got money under that to survey their land, survey all their land. And they did, they surveyed all their land. They never have to survey it again. And so now the only question is when, you know, when there's a project, you know, what do they need to do to avoid the archaeological sites there or to mitigate? Because they've already done everything else. Very few agencies have done that, but it's a great plan. You know, most agencies deal with this on a project-by-project basis, which can be very inefficient. You know, they do one survey for the walkway, and then they do another survey for the outhouse, and they do another survey for the cabin, and they do another survey for the dock, and they do another survey. You know, so they do these little patchwork surveys, you know, hundreds in some cases of little patchwork surveys every year, some of which overlap, and yet they never really get a sense of what's going on in the landscape. And as a consequence, it's often difficult to figure out what's important and what's not because you don't really know what's there. Some agencies have used archaeological predictive modeling as part of their planning strategy. And in the way you do this is, you know, you do some survey, and then you use those data as a training set to try to figure out what's likely to occur in the rest of the landscape. And, you know, it's a guess. Well, it's a prediction, which is different than a guess. But as a federal agency, you can take that to the state government or the advisory council or somebody with authority and say, you know, look, we've got a bunch of data, and we have a model, and we think this is what we really need to do. You know, there's nothing out there in the desert, but up here in the hills, there's a ton of important sites. So we're not going to worry about the desert anymore. We're just going to do whatever we want there, unless you require us to do something different. But we're really going to look very carefully before we do anything up in the hills. Now, if you can come up with a plan like that, that the SHPO and the TIPO and other people go for, you're way ahead of the game. It's also just good to know what, you know, what you're dealing with, and predictive modeling can help you do that. Some agencies also do regional archaeological planning, because you need to bear in mind that, you know, you're working with SHPOs and you're working with TIPOs, and they all have their own parochial concerns. But archaeological cultures are regional, and some federal agencies manage their properties or their business regionally. So the EPA, the Fish and Wildlife Service, the military, the Forest Service, they all have regions that are bigger than states, you know. And, you know, it may be that each state wants, like, a Mississippian site. But if you're a federal agency, you might have 100 Mississippian sites that you're preserving on your land in the next state over. And so Rhode Island asks you to do something. You say, look, you know, we've got 100 of those over in Massachusetts. Well, you know, Rhode Island may not be happy about that, but if it's reasonable and defensible, the federal agency might well get away with it. And finally, a lot of this is done these days. Almost all of this is done in GIS, which, of course, stands for Geographic Information Systems. So the storage and retrieval and study of these data almost always takes place within the context of geographic information system science. And it's a very useful set of skills to have if you're planning to go on in archaeology. And FAU offers certificates and minors in it, and you should, you know, if you're serious about archaeology, you should definitely be taking some of those classes. Now, one other thing that the National Historic Preservation Act requires is that archaeological materials, as well as documentation, the records associated with the archaeological project, be curated. And it's important to remember the records. It's important to remember that the records are involved, because without the records, the artifacts themselves may be meaningless, because the records tell you where they came from, right? So the National Historic Preservation Act requires the curation of archaeological materials and records. Bear in mind that also the Antiquities Act and the Archaeological Resources Protection Act, which we haven't talked about yet, also require curation. So there are at least three federal laws that require curation. The National Park Service, back some years ago, issued in 1990 a curation regulation, which is not its real name, but it's something like the Federal Regulation for the Curation of Federally Owned or Managed or Controlled Archaeological Collections, or something like that. And it was published at Title 36, Part 79 of the Code of Federal Regulations. And it's available to you on the website. And it spells out the requirements, which are, on the one hand, commonsensical, but also fairly complicated and extensive. And, you know, it basically requires things to be kept safe. But what does that mean? Well, it turns out that, you know, some things need to have climate control and other things don't. Things need to be periodically inventoried. They should be safe from water damage. You need to have a safety copy of the records kept in a fireproof safe. There should be physical security, like, you know, security guards and locks and things like that. There shouldn't be overhead pipes. You know, when you get down into the weeds, there's a bunch of fairly commonsensical but, like, extensive requirements for stuff to be kept safe. And the curation regulation basically lays out how you should think about that. It's a real problem because there aren't a lot of curation facilities around. Most museums are more than full. Few repositories really meet the requirements of the curation regulation. Federal agencies have to pay for this service. And they don't really want to, but they do have to. The National Park Service, the federal government in general, the professional societies are all concerned about this and have been working on it now for some years without much resolution. So do be familiar with the requirements for curation that are expressed in the regulation, and bear in mind which laws it is that require it. There are a number of laws that relate in one way or another to the National Historic Preservation Act. One of the most important is the National Environmental Policy Act. A lot of people see the abbreviation NEPA and think it's National Environmental Protection Act, and it's not. It's the National Environmental Policy Act. And the Policy Act has really draconian penalties for violations. And it also requires preservation of cultural stuff. Unfortunately, some individuals or some agencies think that if they comply with NEPA, they've complied with the National Preservation Act. And that's not true. They are completely separate laws. And even though they require some of the same things, they need to be complied with separately. The good thing is that you can sometimes comply with one by using the same documentation that you've created for the other. So if you've done an archaeological survey, you only need to do it once. You don't need to do it twice, once for NEPA and once for NHPA. You just do it once and you turn in the report twice. You get two copies, right? The Federal Department of Transportation, interestingly enough, has a separate but very similar archaeological and historic preservation mandate that occurs in Section 4F of the Department of Transportation Act. It basically requires them to do the same kind of thing. And I don't know how that relates to the Advisory Council, because, you know, they don't fall under the Advisory Council exactly. But they end up doing basically the same kind of thing. There are also a bunch of other federal laws that are related in one way or another to preservation. So, for example, the Federal Property and Administrative Services Act created the General Services Administration, and they're responsible for administering both federal real property and federal personal property. And so there's some language in there about government buildings and also about things like museum collections that are relevant to preservation. The Federal Records Act requires that the federal government retain its records in accordance with records retention schedules that have to be approved by the National Archives and Record Administration, which was created by the Federal Records Act in 1949. And so basically the National Archives determines what records get destroyed and which ones get saved and when they get destroyed, if they get destroyed, and things like that. You can't just, in the federal government, arbitrarily destroy records. In fact, if you'll notice, in federal government scandals, one of the things that people, you know, people rarely go to jail for the crime. They go to jail for the cover-up, notoriously, right? And the reason they go to jail for the cover-up is because they destroyed federal records and thereby violated the Federal Records Act. There's also the Abandoned Shipwrecked Act, which is relevant in Florida because it conveyed title to shipwrecks within the three-mile limit from the federal government to the state governments, and the state governments have, like, often messed up in taking responsibility for those things. There's the old Reservoir Salvage Act, which has some of the same requirements as the National Historic Preservation Act, but is rarely applicable today. So, in conclusion, the National Historic Preservation Act is by far the most important and most complicated and extensive historic preservation law in the United States. It's really the centerpiece of historic preservation legislation in the federal government of the United States of America. For practicing archaeologists, the most important provision of that law is Section 106, which requires federal agencies to carry out both archaeological surveys and evaluations of archaeological sites before federal agencies carry out any undertakings. And this is what actually generates the contract work, as well as the compliance work in the state and federal and local governments, that generate most of the employment for practicing professional archaeologists. And so we're going to talk about this a little bit more, a lot more, as the term goes on, because actually carrying out those responsibilities is what you'll be doing if you get a job in this field after graduation.